I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. This Sunday, April 24th, is Remembrance Day for the Armenian Genocide, a horrific event that occurred during World War I. And I thought this would be a good time to cover the topic on the show. Fortunately for us, we did a great episode on this topic, and I can't even believe this, 4 years ago? I was in my 30s then. But I had the honor of speaking with Ron Suni. Ron is professor of history at the University of Michigan, one of the icons in the field of not only Soviet and Russian history, but also the history of nationalities. Someone who understands the notions of ethnicity and nationalism. He himself studied in the Soviet Union, has connections with the modern nation of Armenia, which was one of the former Soviet republics. And this conversation was brilliant. Ron is just he's a sage. And our conversation covered so many more topics than just the Armenian Genocide. We spoke about the way people imagine history, the way that who we are is tied up in it, and how that can prevent us from actually understanding our past better. Can't even tell you how much I enjoyed listening back to this episode. I'm also going to say there's a little discussion about Russia in the modern times and Putin at the end. I think it'll be an interesting reflection for anybody who is now watching what's happening in Ukraine, the horrors and the brutality being unleashed by Russia, Putin's madman's war. But yeah, so it's really nice to be able to share this episode. Again, Ron was always so kind to me when I was a graduate student in Michigan State. I would go visit University of Michigan and went to workshops there. Just really a guy who welcomed me in. And I think anybody who has ever met this guy will tell you he is a kind person. Speaking of kind people, want to say a shout out to our patrons. You guys keep us going. Guys, if you're listening to the show and you enjoy it, and you know, you got a couple extra bucks a month, hey, there you go. You can still, yeah, let's be fair, you can still get this podcast even if you don't pay for it. But if you did, that'd be helpful to all of us because this thing costs money. Fortunately, a lot of people have already signed up, and those people are getting ready to see the schedule that I'm going to post, because we're going to be doing trivia. Our trivia nights are going to be back in May. We haven't done one in a while. And honestly, I miss you guys. I was the one who was like, you guys want to do trivia? We got a good, firm response. And so patrons, be looking out for the poll. That'll be up this week. If you guys want to have some say-so and when we do this trivia, come join us on Patreon. That's patreon.com/theroadtonow. Maybe, though, you're thinking, right now I can't afford a few extra bucks. Well, that is okay. I've been there a lot in my life. You know what you could do, though, if you wanted to help us out that would be free? Just go make sure that you have rated and reviewed us on Apple Podcasts. I know that every podcast you listen to says this, and the reason they do is because it has a profound impact on where you are in the polls. Polls, what is this? In the ratings on the lists. And then once you're there, you're more visible. And so fortunately, we've been staying in those lists for a while now, and help us move up. Just go there, Apple Podcasts, give us a 5 stars, and the kicker is, maybe you've already given us 5 stars, but you didn't write a review. Oh man, the reviews, they mean so much. So thanks to everyone who's done that, and thanks to everyone who is about to do that, because you guys were like, hey, that's pretty easy, we could help these guys out. Anyway, we'll be back next week with a new episode. Hope everyone out there had a good Easter. And hope you enjoy this brilliant conversation with the always, always delightful Ron Suni. Ron Suni, welcome to The Road to Now.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's great to have you here. I've known you a long time, but we've just gotten to where at MTSU we have a Genocide and Holocaust Conference, and we brought you in as a keynote speaker, and I'm so happy to have you here. This coming Tuesday, the 24th of April, is Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day, and the paper that you've come here to present to the audience at MTSU is about this genocide and the Ottoman Empire, and beautifully named for our podcast is How These Things Affect the World Today. Could you start off by explaining to us the story of the Armenian Genocide, its causes, and why the Armenians became a target in the Ottoman Empire during World War I?
This story might take 2,000 years to tell, but I'll try to shorten it a little bit. Yes. So in the late Ottoman Empire, let's say roughly from the 1870s till the fall of the empire in the early 1920s, Armenians moved from being a relatively privileged group, a group that was considered the Milleti Sadika, that is in Ottoman Turkish, the faithful millet, the one that was loyal, that didn't try like the Greeks and Bulgarians and Romanians and Serbs and Albanians to revolt against the country, to the largest group minority in the country that was then suspected of being some kind of subversive threat to the empire, right? And it really starts in the 1870s at the time of the Russo-Turkish War of 1877-78, when Armenians, sympathetic to their idea that they need protection, that they need some autonomy perhaps in the empire, that there certainly has to be reforms, petitioned the Western powers, particularly Russia, which had just beaten the Turks in that war, for some protection, some reforms. And that already aroused in the then Sultan of the empire, this famous bloody Sultan Abdulhamid II, the idea that the Armenians were in fact a treacherous group that were threatening the unity of the empire. And so eventually, in alliance with Kurdish nomads and various officials, beys as they were called at the time, the emperor, the sultan, launched massacres against the Armenians in parts of Turkey. Right? That's stage one of what would become this process. Those massacres, of which affected my own family, in fact, my mother's mother was in a place called Diyarbakir, which is now in what you'd call Eastern Turkey or Kurdistan. They fled after that massacre to the United States. That has been connected by many Armenian historians and others with what would come later. That is a series of massacres that led up to the mass killing deportations of 1915, which we call the Armenian Genocide. In my own work, I try to separate these things as distinct events. Abdulhamid was not eliminating all Armenians. He was interested in repressing them, suppressing them, restoring a relatively conservative order in which Turks would be on top, Muslims would be on top, and Armenians and other minorities would be below, right? So that was the first stage. But this mentality that Armenians were a subversive force allied with the West, that they represented an existential threat to the empire, became extremely strong later, roughly right before World War I, when a reforming, formerly revolutionary group called the Young Turks was in power. And a small triumvirate of these Young Turks, in fact, took a very radical view. And when the war began, they decided that they would use this opportunity to eliminate the Armenians. And they literally, in 1915, rounded up first the men with guns who they had mobilized into the Ottoman Empire, disarmed them, and murdered them. That is, they murdered their former soldiers. And then they led expeditions into various towns in eastern Anatolia and eastern Turkey today, and rounded up men, took them out of the town, murdered them, and then marched women, children, old folks, etc., through the mountains, through the deserts. People died in the tens of thousands during those events. And when they finally got to the deserts of Syria, places like Deir Zor or Raqqa, so the places you may be familiar with because ISIS had controlled these not so long ago, they were there starved and eventually again massacred. So this genocide resulted in at least 800,000 deaths and the removal of 90% of Armenians from what is now the state of Turkey, and took sort of three different stages. There was the mass killing I've described. There were the deportations which I've described. And then there was a kind of cultural genocide. Those who did survive, say women, children, were forcibly converted into Islam. And so hundreds of thousands of Armenians somehow survived by no longer being Armenians. They exist today. Their grandchildren exist today in Turkey.
And this is an interesting time. For those of you who aren't familiar with the history of the Ottoman Empire, Syria was a part of the Ottoman Empire.
Absolutely.
These modern nations of Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, these were all carved out after World War I because the Ottoman Empire sided with Germany and was on the losing end of World War I. There is, I think, when we look back at this, sometimes people will take modern notions of difference and apply them over the past, and perhaps overestimate them. A lot has been made of the religious difference because Armenians were Christians. Armenia was, at least according to Armenian tradition, the first nation to adopt Christianity. But you've actually said that some people maybe have overstated the importance of religion to the Young Turks in this decision to purge Armenians.
Whenever you see a conflict in the world between people who are Muslim and those people who are Christian or were once Muslim and once Christian, you know, then it seems to be a religious conflict. But in fact, these events were not directly the result of religious differences. Religion in the Ottoman Empire was a marker of difference. Different religious communities were organized in what were called milets, a word that at that time meant religious community and has come to mean in modern Turkish nations. But these were different groups. So there was the Ermeni millet, which was made up of Armenians, Assyrians, and other related Christian groups. And there was the dominant millet, the ruling millet of Muslims. There was a Jewish millet, and so forth. Those markers and those distinctions were known. But the actual killings and so forth, which came about after many centuries of these people living together, right? So it was possible for people of the book, as Jews and Christians were called, to live with the dominant Muslim community, and Islam is supposed to protect the people of the book. Suddenly this changes. So it can't be religion particularly. It had to be something that changed in that modern era, in that particular historical conjuncture of the very end of the Ottoman Empire, and particularly World War I. And that was that now the leaders of the Young Turks had developed a mentality, I call it an affective disposition, an emotional disposition. In their imagination, the Armenians had become tied to the Russians, threatening their existence, the Turkish existence, and actively planning insurrection. Now, none of these things was actually true. There were many Armenians who were sympathetic to the Russians. Some even defected to the Russians, who were on the other side, of course, in World War I. But the great bulk of the Armenians, and this is a fact that's often forgotten, were loyal to the Ottoman Empire. This was their home. This was their empire. They wished to have reforms. They wanted more autonomy. They wanted to be protected by the government, not put upon by the local Kurdish nomads and bandits and so forth, but they in fact wanted to stay in the Ottoman Empire. And tens of thousands of young Armenians actually fought in the Ottoman Empire army, the army of the Ottoman Empire, against the Russians and died for that empire. But then they were disarmed because of this affective disposition, this worldview of the Young Turks, and they were murdered, right? So the first thing that Young Turks did was remove what you could call the muscle of the Armenian people, the young men with guns. And then they arrested the intellectuals in Istanbul, the party leaders, the writers, murdered them. That's, they removed the brain. They decapitated the nation.
Right.
And yet they still argued that no, Armenians were a danger. And so they removed women, children, old people, off into the mountains, off into the desert, and massacred or starved them later.
You've said in your in some of the other works you've written that when you began investigating this event, you yourself were reluctant to call it genocide. And I think there's a brilliance to this, that you said you yourself had not investigated the evidence, but now you say there's no question about this. And you face criticism from people on both sides, first for not saying it was genocide and now for saying it's genocide. What were the key elements that really made that turned you to the point where you said this is definitely a genocide?
First of all, you have to understand what genocide means, right? And people use this term very loosely. So almost any mass killing is called a genocide nowadays, right? But genocide is carefully defined in a limited way by the United Nations Genocide Convention. I think that's a handy, useful definition.
Right.
And we shouldn't try to change those definitions arbitrarily. And that definition itself came about as a kind of compromise between the great powers and others during the discussions in the 1940s about that genocide resolution. And ultimately, the definition is that it's a targeted, intentional killing by a state of an ethnic, religious, racial, as they put it in their language, cultural group, right? It is not just the killing of a social class or a political movement you're opposed to or whatever. It is not war. It's not the bombing of Dresden. It's not Hiroshima, terrible mass killings, but they're very different. It's when a government says, I want to get rid of this particular ethnic group, this national group, or I want to render them so impotent that they can no longer oppose me or organize coherently, right? And so the Holocaust would be a model of that, and that's actually where the term came. And the Armenian Genocide was also this kind of targeted killing of a specific national group, the Armenians, and also the Assyrians who were closely linked to them. In other words, I would put it this way succinctly. Genocide is not the killing of people. It is the killing of a people.
Right. Right. And so this once you looked at the evidence,
there's no question that the Armenians were targeted. They were targeted because they were Armenian. They were imagined as an existential threat. And therefore, this government decided in its own self-defense, in their own vision, they would have to get rid of them. Men, women, children, everybody.
So this is interesting because here we have so many events in history where there is the evidence and then there is the gut sentiment. And even today, over 100 years later, scholars such as yourself, scholars from all over the world have looked at this and said, yes, they agree with your position. This is clearly genocide. We still live in a world where the vast majority of countries have not recognized this. The United States to varying degrees has, but not officially. Even Israel itself has denied the existence of this being a genocide. And the Turkish government to this day denies that it was a genocide. Could you talk about what is the Turkish side of this story and why have so many other states in the world been so reluctant to deem this a genocide whenever the experts in the field overwhelmingly side with you?
There are several different Turkish positions and they shift over time. There were times when even the mass killing was denied. But at the moment, there is a kind of understanding that, yes, killing took place. Armenians were victims, but so were Turks victims, right? So 18% of Turks, that is Muslims, in Anatolia lost their lives in World War I. Of course, the Turkey was fighting the Russians and the British and everybody else. And there wasn't any governmental decision or even Armenian insurrection to kill them. But that was one thing. And 90-some percent of Armenians were killed. So something's going on when you see that kind of disparity. The Turkish position is that there was a civil war, that Armenians were a danger, that the Turks were protecting themselves. So it's a kind of national security argument, right? And there was collateral damage. That's a phrase that Americans use whenever they're bombing civilians. There's collateral damage. That is, unfortunately, also other people were victims as well. But it wasn't the intention to get rid of Armenians. It wasn't the intention to massively kill them. This was just an unfortunate residue of these events. So there is, and I should mention this, progressive, intellectually honest Turks, Kurds, and others who have done this investigation and have come to these same conclusions. There's a whole younger generation of Ottoman scholars doing beautiful research on this. Now, that is difficult to say and defend in Turkey today,
right,
where the government continues to deny this. And other states like Israel, the United States, because of their complex strategic relationships with Turkey, a NATO ally after all, also refuses to defend this. And one of the most egregious cases was President Obama and his regime. And Obama, in fact, had said he would recognize it. Many people said they would recognize it. He calls it Metz Yeren, the term used in Armenian meaning great tragedy or great catastrophe. But then even with Samantha Power, who had, in fact, written about this event within his administration, they publicly would not go out and say this, that it was a genocide. Of course, Samantha Power, after she left the administration, now she's somewhere in Harvard. Now she again says, yes, I'm sorry, it was a genocide. So this is all about politics and tactical strategic choices made by governments to keep their alliances intact.
Wow, it's always amazing when you see that politics interferes with a general agreement on something.
Really amazing, isn't it? or just true, or just frequently the case.
Ron is someone who is also an amazing Soviet scholar. May have dealt a lot of his life with publishing things that during the Cold War that the general public did not want to hear about the Soviet Union,
or even today.
True. So your talk today is entitled, How This Genocide Affects the World Today. I can tell you to start off, one clear way that it affects the world that I live in every day is that my wife, Kelly Kolar, is the descendant of an Armenian family that fled the Ottoman Empire during the genocide. They fled to California, where they have become incredibly successful, mostly in the Central Valley. Incredibly wonderful family. And that's my wife. And in fact, my son is a legacy of this event. So to me,
he has a little bit of Armenian. That's the good part. Yeah. Okay.
That's right. And if that part links him to the rest of his family, the Puchigans and the Hovsepians, I will take it because they're wonderful people. So that's you know, my personal relationship. Obviously, you have family ties there. But what are the big ways that you see that this event is really affecting us today in our world?
The argument I'm going to try to make in a lot of detail, too much detail today, probably for most people's ears, is that the Armenian issue, the question of the genocide, became a touchstone in the 1990s and particularly in the 2000s. For more progressive, European-oriented, liberal-minded, democratically interested Turks and Kurds in Turkey today to expand the democracy, the pluralism, and the tolerance in Turkish society and politics, right? So this issue was a kind of thin wedge which people, Turkish scholars and all, not to mention Armenians living in Turkey, there's still 50 or 60,000 there, that thin wedge they use to undermine the dominant Kemalist nationalist discourse of how Turkey was formed and what kind of state it was. The denial of the genocide. The fact that just before Turkey was founded, they had committed this horrendous crime. That the War of Liberation, the Kurtuluş Savaşı, as it's called in Turkish, that founded the Turkish state, in fact, was tainted by these events that had occurred just before and that continued in wars against Armenia and Armenians during the early Kemalist period.
Could you take a second and just explain what you mean by the Kemalist Revolution?
So the Ottoman Empire came to an end. It was defeated in World War I in 1918. It was occupied by British and French and other forces, right? Capital, Istanbul, etc. And as the Ottoman Empire begins to live through its last death throes, a nationalist movement led by Kemal Atatürk, Mustafa Kemal, developed in the east, in the central and eastern parts of Turkey. And that ultimately defeated the Ottoman Empire and took over and formed the modern Turkish state. That Kemalist nationalism argues that Turkey is for Turks, Turkey for Turks, and that everyone should be a Turk. You know, if you're Armenian or Kurdish or whatever, you actually should be definitely a Turkish citizen. And we will tolerate, because of the Lausanne Treaty, we will tolerate these minorities. And by the way, Kurds, for most of that history, were not really a different nationality. They were mountain Kurds, or they were Laps Turks. They were mountain Turks, excuse me, or they were Laps Turks or something of that sort. This has become the problem. So the first legacy I want to mention is that this issue of the genocide, which should be a small issue in Turkey, right? There aren't that many Armenians there. This happened 100 years ago. Why can't they deal with it, right? Because it undermines Turkish identity. That it's become a weapon in the hands of more democratic Turks and Kurds to undermine the more dictatorial, authoritarian aspects of Turkish society and politics.
Aha, so it is a challenge to the historical narrative that underlies the legitimacy of the current regime.
You got it. That's exactly right. And secondly, the Turkish government and many others have linked the Armenian question with the current really difficult question for Turkey today, the Kurdish question. There are tens of millions of Kurds, that is people with an Indo-European language, a different culture, living throughout Turkey, mainly because they live throughout Turkey because some 4,000 villages in Kurdistan were destroyed in the 1990s, and they had to flee to Europe and to Western Turkey.
That was Iraq, correct?
What? No, that was in Eastern Turkey. That was in Turkey today. But it's an event that most Americans and others don't know about. And today there are Kurds in Turkey, tens of millions, as I'm saying, who are not allowed to study their own language. Kurdish children have to come into Turkish schools and learn Turkish from day one, right? And their own language is denied. There is repression of the Turkish autonomy. There's removal of Turkish Kurdish mayors, and so in general, right now Kurds have been pacified. They were defeated in attacks by the Turkish army within Turkey. I'm talking about in the last few years, right? And though the Kurdish repression is linked by Kurds in their imagination to the Armenian early genocide, and they say popularly and very often, the Turks had you for breakfast and they're going to have us for lunch.
Wow.
Right? So there's this very powerful link. And even though Kurds were involved as perpetrators during the 1915 mass killings, right? Kurds were urged and given permission by the Ottoman state to carry out these massacres and take Armenian property, live in Armenian homes, and they still live there today. Despite that, today, Kurds recognize the genocide. The official liberation movement of the Kurds, the PKK, which we call a terrorist group, that group recognizes the genocide. And Kurds and Armenians are, in a funny way, allies against the repressions of the Turkish state.
Is this something along similar lines to the stories that you hear that emerged in Eastern Europe? Where countries such as, places such as Poland in particular, where the historical narrative glossed over with the Holocaust in particular, right? That there were local Poles who participated in this in some places in Ukraine. But the narrative is so founded in being victims of another country that they write out these atrocities that they participated in?
You know, Ben, as a historian, that history is a very dangerous science, right? It is by its essence subversive of unquestioned assumptions or what you might call historical common sense, the myths on which every nation is founded, right? And in America, we also engage in the demythifying, demythologizing history, bringing back the story of slavery or the My Lai massacres in Vietnam or what the genocidal actions against the Native Americans. So, there's always this effort to undermine by historians, good historians, undermine and recreate and revise the old denialist narratives and look face to face, honestly, brutally at what really happened and how we got where we are, right? That's the task of historians or good critical historians. And it happens a lot in America. And there are many brave Turks and Kurds now, scholars who are trying to do the same thing, but under very difficult conditions, right? That is important. And it is quite like what goes on in Russia or Eastern Europe or in many other countries. No one's free of this. In Israel, of course, with the way they have to deal with the Nakba, the removal of the Palestinians. All of those kinds of revisionist efforts are extraordinarily important. And states and more conservative people and people who want to keep to the denialist narratives of what their real history is, of course, fight against that. So there's a struggle always.
The historical narratives that we tell ourselves, they're so tied to power. They're so tied to legitimacy.
Right. They're about legitimizing the state's existence, its right to this real estate, to its homeland, as they call it, despite whoever else might have lived there through history. And it is also a legitimation, more radically even, of the existing current distribution of wealth, property, and power, right? And history and the study of nations, of the origins of capitalism, of the fate of socialism, all of those things are potentially subversive ways of demythologizing those accepted, unquestioned histories.
And you have a long history with this, right? It was your first book, The Making of the Georgian Nation, and some of your other scholarship has made you unpopular with some folks by pointing out the historical truth that perhaps their notions of identity is not eternal.
Yeah, but it's so much fun to do that. but now I'm Armenian. I was born in the United States, but I'm an Armenian. My parents were Armenian. I had to go to graduate school to learn the language because it's not an easy one and they wouldn't speak to me. But still, I'm also questioning the narrative's Armenian history, which doesn't make me particularly popular with many more conservative Armenians. Now, what I have found in recent years and in a recent trip to Armenia is the younger generation is really interested in this. That is, after 70 years of being cut off through the because they lived in Soviet Armenia, the new generation wants to engage in these new ways of understanding nationalism and seeing how nationalism is, as so brilliantly put by Benedict Anderson, an imagined community. The nation is a community we imagine we belong to. And these are human creations. They're not given by nature. It's not a matter of blood. It's a matter of the historical experience that we get to be where we are or who we think we are. And that's very threatening to some nations, and particularly a small people like Armenians, a people who have been threatened, who are surrounded by people they think of as enemies, whose whole history and existence has been questioned. Of course, they're nervous and threatened by these more constructivist ideas of nation rather than the more naturalized primordial ideas. Or as Milan Kundera so brilliantly said it, you know, he's a Czech small nation. He said, small nations know they can disappear. Small nations can disappear and they know it. That's a better way of putting it. So that kind of anxiety about your own existence in a place like Israel or with Palestinians or with Czechs or with Armenians is part of the reality of how these people have to imagine themselves.
All right, and just to clarify for listeners, Ron just referenced Soviet Armenia, and this is these are the borders that are the modern state of Armenia. So there is a nation state of Armenia, but this was only a part of where Armenians lived, much of which went into Turkey. And interestingly enough, if you go to Armenia, one of the symbols of Armenia is Mount Ararat. This, you know, supposedly, according to the myth, where Noah's Ark landed.
Myth?
According to fact, where Noah's Ark landed. If you sit in Yerevan, which I've been there, it's a beautiful place, you can see Ararat in the distance, and it is like something out of a painting, but it is also in Turkey.
That's right. There's a famous story that the Turks complained to the foreign minister of the Soviet Union, foreign commissar Chechenin, in the 1920s and said, how come you allow Armenia to have Mount Ararat on its seal as a symbol of Armenia when it's in Turkey? And Chechenin famously said to the Turks, well, you have the moon and the star on your arm. So, you know, it's not exactly. Yeah, Armenians like to say that we have the better view of the Ararat. So it's across the border in Turkey, Mount Ararat, which is called, by the way, in Turkish, Ara, which means Mount Pain. It changes its name a little bit. But I've actually been, and we do have a beautiful view in Armenia of Ararat. It comes looming out of the plain. But I've been on the Turkish side in the Idlib, and in fact, the Turks have a beautiful view too. Both sides of Ararat are worth looking at.
It is interesting what you say about Armenia, because I've been to several parts of the former Soviet Union. I haven't been to any of the Central Asian republics, but I've been to Georgia, I've been to Armenia, Ukraine. And the funny thing that I found is that Armenia seemed to be of the ones that I've been to, what I know of a lot of the other ones, they spoke Russian because they were part of the Soviet Union. That was their second language, and it was the main language of the Soviet Union. And in every other former Soviet republic I'm aware of, except for Russia, obviously, there's been this drive to purge Russian from people's knowledge. And a push towards English. Armenia is the only one that I'm aware of and that I experienced where they have not rejected Russian. They've continued to be okay speaking Russian, but they just learn English in addition. My experience in Georgia was that I would walk in places and speak to the older people in Russian because I knew that they spoke Russian. But if I started with Russian, they would be angry at me. And then I would switch to English and they would reluctantly switch back to Russian. But if I started with English, they would panic and then be happy when I spoke Russian. Mm. Why is it that Armenia is not so adamant about getting rid of Russian in the way others?
It's a complicated thing. First of all, Georgia and Russia are hostile states to one another. And part of Georgia, according to the Georgians, is occupied by the Russians. The Abkhaz and South Ossetians might disagree with that, but you know, in terms of international law, there's Russian occupation and autonomous or independence movements in parts of the country that belongs to Georgia. Armenia is an ally of Russia. It is defended by Russia against Azerbaijan and against Turkey. So there's more sympathy. Now, lots of Armenians chafe at this Russian dependence, on the dependence on Russia. There was an event a little while ago where a Russian soldier in Armenia went berserk and murdered a whole Armenian family. And so there's often these kinds of resentments and so forth. But after an initial phase of pushing Russia or marginalizing Russia, Russian language aside after the independence, they've come back and understood that, no, we're part of this larger post-Soviet sphere. This is a language, a lingua franca, that we can use with other republics, with the Russians, etc. Television is available in Russia. And so Russian is back. Armenians always were pretty good at Russian. It's an Indo-European language. They share certain affinities with it. And because of this alliance and dependence, it explains a lot of this sort of revival of Russian.
And Armenia, I don't know if this was just a fact I got from a nationalist in Armenia, but the highest concentration of highest percentage of population with a PhD in the former Soviet Union.
That's one of the claims we could make. Yes, there were too many people with higher degrees of education produced in Armenia, so they exported them, and we had the highest export of doctors and masters and of science and so forth throughout the Soviet Union. So a good part of the Armenian intelligentsia went all over the Soviet Union. And I had relatives in Leningrad, in Baku, and in Tashkent, all of whom had gone, either been living there or were sent there from what originally been more Armenian areas.
And just for those who don't know, Baku is in Azerbaijan, and Tashkent is in Uzbekistan. So those are pretty distant places from Armenia. Well, not so much Baku, but Baku is close, even if it may seem far away.
There are no Armenians there, or very few now, because they were expelled after the pogroms that took place in Azerbaijan and the forced expelling of Azerbaijanis from Armenia.
Did I ever tell you, Ron, that whenever I was in Armenia with Kelly, we met up with Jeremy Johnson, and he drove us from Yerevan up to Tbilisi, but that we went a back road and we almost unintentionally crossed over the Armenian-Azerbaijani border.
You all would have been safe. Maybe Kelly would not have been so safe. Jeremy Johnson is my PhD student about to defend his dissertation on Armenian education and literacy in the early 20s.
And as we went across, a border guard like screamed at us and pointed out that there may have been some troops out there on the border looking towards Armenia, and that we may not have lasted long had we made that wrong turn. So obviously you have a personal connection to this because of your family. But what was it, because you, it's kind of this interesting story where you were one of the few people in the United States who specialized in the non-Russian portions of the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union collapsed and people suddenly rediscovered that there were places like Armenia and Georgia and these ethnic republics, you were the guy on TV talking about this on the major news networks. How did you decide, kind of against the flow of most other people, to focus your research on the non-Russian areas? Was it your family, or was there something else that drove you there?
Yeah, it must have been some of those things. My father lived in Tbilisi, and he left after the revolution as a child through Batumi to Turkey and then to the United States. So we always heard about these parts of the world. And the family was a kind of left-wing family. That is, my father's side was. The mother's side was more churchy and more conservative, but I got both sides of it. And my grandfather had even been a member of the Communist Party of the United States. It must have been the United States, because though they were an Armenian group in Philadelphia, a little group. So we always heard about the Soviet Union and about Armenia and all those things. And I had this childhood interest in those things. I was even called Comrade Sunni by by my schoolmates before I graduated from high school. So I always had that interest. So I went into the field to find out what's actually going on. What is this thing called the Soviet Union? And I was really interested in that from that particular point of view. And so choosing the dissertation topic about the revolution in Baku, the capital of today of Azerbaijan, which was led by an Armenian, Stepan Shaumian, seemed a natural choice. And I didn't think about what would be saleable. At those times, it was easy to get a job in Russian history relative to today. And so you didn't worry about that so much. And so I became interested in the history of the Caucasus. And nobody cared, right? Nobody cared. The book was published by Princeton University Press. That was fine. Then I went and did a book on on Georgia, and then another one on Armenia. So I was an expert kind of in that area of the Soviet Caucasus. And then, boof, comes 1988, 1989, and the Soviet Union is exploding, and CBS calls and PBS calls and this one and that one. And it was really exciting. I had my 15 minutes of fame. And then one day I was at my mother's house. I'm going to tell you this story. And the phone rings and they said, "Professor Suni, yes, we'd like you to come to Washington and talk to us." I said, "Well, who are you?" And they said, "Well, we're the Central Intelligence Agency."
Wow.
And I said, "Really? Do you know anything about me?" And they said, "We know all about you." So, and I talked to my colleagues back in Michigan, and they said, "Well, you're a citizen. You know, they've been listening to these right-wingers all the time, right? So why don't they listen to you now? I mean, you're an expert." And I went, and I spent a good time, you know, talking and never making a secret of it, never shown anything classified or anything like that, but explained from a scholar's point of view what was going on, what was it likely to happen. I always told my students about what was going on and so forth. Nothing was hidden or so forth. And that worked for a couple, you know, years or 10 years or so. I don't remember. Hopefully some influence of scholarship on government policy actually occurred with me and others who were becoming experts in Central Asia, the Caucasus, Ukraine, and so forth. I don't know. Today it seems we're a long way away from that.
Yeah. So you actually studied in the Soviet Union during the Soviet era. What was the first year you went? When was the first time you went to the Soviet Union?
I went the first year. It was 1964 in October. I was there when Khrushchev fell from power, Nikita Khrushchev, who had been head of the Communist Party and replaced by Brezhnev and Kosygin, 1964. I remember that day very well. Our plane was going from Tashkent to Leningrad, from one set of relatives to another. It was brought down in Chelyabinsk. We were taken off the plane, were kept there for 8 hours, then put back on the plane. Didn't know anything that was going on. Only when we reached Leningrad did we find out that Khrushchev had been removed. And I went to find out. There was no news about it at all. Swan Lake was playing on television. And I thought to myself, oh, if only I were in New York now, I could find out what's going on. But there I was in the Soviet Union. And then the next year I went, 65, 66, I had a wonderful year as an exchange student and lived there and experienced it and loved it. I loved being in the Soviet Union. I loved the people there. I was enthusiastic about what I hoped they were going to build, which was a more democratic socialist society. They built a kind of big welfareist authoritarian society, but with Gorbachev later, I was always hopeful they might find the road to a system between kind of neoliberal capitalism, which was then powerful in the West, and state socialism or whatever it was, Stalinism on the other side. But that effort sadly failed.
Yeah. And now reflecting on having spent this time in the Soviet Union and seeing what's happened, how do you understand Putin's relationship to this Soviet era? Is he a logical conclusion to it? Is he a diversion?
That's a good question. No, Putin is a product of the Soviet Union. I often say you can take Russia out of the Soviet Union, but you can't take the Soviet Union out of Russia. That is, there is a legacy. You can't give up on your experience, neither Tsarist experience, which is some distant way, but the Soviet experience, which is only a quarter of a century away. And he was, in fact, a KGB guy, right? At a moment, by the way, when the KGB had been changed. This isn't Stalin's KGB, you know, or an NKVD. This is a reformed KGB that had been changed over and had become the leading force for crushing dissidents, crushing any possible opposition to the rule of the Communist Party, and the leading force against corruption, right?
Right.
So this is the Putin that came out of that. And he was very dedicated. He was a patriot. He regretted the fall of the Soviet Union. He was stunned by the fall of the Soviet Union. He wants to make sure that doesn't happen to Russia. And here's a guy, very competent, very smart, very tough, maybe even very brutal, who, with that experience, is playing a very weak hand. Russia's a very weak country. It spends less than 10% of what the U.S. spends for defense, and not mentioning NATO. And yet he's trying to sort of make Russia a kind of great again, you know, make it a great power without the kinds of resources, either economically or militarily, that he can really do that, right? So there's a bit of ambition that's a little bit of overreach for the capability. And we have this huge struggle in the world between Putin and Russia, which wants to sort of dominate its area as much as possible, not build the Soviet Union again, but have friendly powers around it, you know, a kind of regional hegemon that people will pay attention and take seriously, against the most powerful state in world history, the United States, which has unbelievable ambitions to be a global hegemon, to extend its power and influence everywhere in the globe, the Mediterranean, South America, the Pacific, Eastern Europe, Middle East, etc. And that's the world that he has to operate in. Right? And with not the resources that the United States or Western Europe has.
So he's trying to prevent a second collapse, as it might be.
And I would argue that his Russia is a very fragile state. It's a state that has not got a very diversified economy, that the ruble at the moment is falling against the dollar. The economy is not doing well. There are all these sanctions. He's trapped in a way in Ukraine. He's now backing Assad, which in that case, they're winning that war. But still, he's tied to this unbelievably brutal dictator in the Middle East who can play against him sometimes to get what he wants. So, you know, there's a wonderful phrase which a good political scientist, very good political scientist at Columbia, Jack Snyder, uses called imperial overreach. Now, you and I know about the United States' imperial overreach, trying to be in Afghanistan and Iraq and backing the Saudis in this brutal war in Yemen and all of the other things. And Putin, though it's a little guy, nevertheless, and a weaker country, still you can have imperial overreach, right? You know, even from a very weak position. And just because it's a weak state doesn't mean it's a benign state, right? It can do all kinds of mischief in the world. And the regret for someone like me who spent a long time studying Russia and Soviet history is none of this has to happen. That is, we have and share interests with Russia in terms of, you know, all kinds of global issues, you know, like climate change, nuclear proliferation, preventing that, keeping the world safe, and all the other things. And yet, because of these various ways in which we've gotten into these messes and the discourses about the other side on both sides, you see the situation we're in.
I just want to go back one last thing before we wrap this up and make a point about why it's important to remember these events such as the genocide of the Armenians, because there is, and a lot of people know this, but a lot of people don't, this famous statement by Hitler at the beginning of the Holocaust.
Apparently, in his table talk, on the eve of the invasion of Poland, which would then begin World War II in a serious way, right? Hitler said something, "Who today remembers the Armenians?" Meaning the Ottoman Turks carried out this genocide. They massacred nearly a million people. And still, no one remembers today. And we can go into Eastern Europe. We can conquer Eastern Europe. We can create Lebensraum, living room. And we can get rid of Jews first and Slavs later and build a German empire, right? So this was the memory of that. Now, that particular statement has been contested seriously by scholars and so forth. That is, did he really say it? How was it reported, etc.? We do know, and there's some wonderful scholarship on this now, and a new scholarship by a guy named Stefan Ehrig, who's teaching in Jerusalem. We know now that Hitler knew all about the genocide, that this was a popular and well-known event in Germany, that he made many statements about it, and that the Armenian genocide, along with the American elimination of Native Americans, was for Hitler a model for what he was going to do in Eastern Europe.
Wow.
And that has come out more and more. That is, he thought about history, and he saw these events, which were a kind of radical national empire-making effort by eliminating the people you don't want because you want the land. We can call that ethnic cleansing if there's no radical killing, or you can call it genocide if, in fact, it's accompanied by mass killing, which is what Hitler intended. It's what the Ottoman Turks did, and it's what the Americans did with the Native Americans.
So I think the lesson here is be careful about what you forget in your national narratives to make yourself comfortable. Sometimes it could have real terrible implications and encourage others to act in terrible ways. Ron Sidney, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Yeah.
It was great to have you. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us spread the word. Text a link to a friend, share a link on social media, or just take a minute to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. That's how word spreads. You could help us with that. Speaking of helping us with that and everything else, we'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians. Tanya Marsh, Mary Hawking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Peggy Donica, Matt Williams, Team Martin, Ann Williams and Frank Edwards, Daniel Hansen, Nate Farrer, and Jennifer N. Magnolia. That list keeps getting longer. Thank you. If you enjoyed The Road to Now or just want to see how long that list has to get before I pass out reading it, support us on Patreon. That's patreon.com/theroadtonow. We got extra episodes there, bonus materials, and they're all there for you. That's patreon.com/theroadtonow. For more on our podcast, you can visit our website, theroadtonow.com. Easily search our back catalog, quickly find links to content, and when you get there, you'll notice, wow, it's a pretty good website. Want to know why? Because it was designed by Seven Ages Design. Go check those guys out if you need a website. They're fantastic. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Ben Sawyer. Our associate producer is Gary Fletcher, and our theme music is by Paul DeFiglia. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Take care, and thanks for listening.